This program is brought to you by Stanford on iTunes U at Stanford University. Please visit us at itunes.stanford.edu.
Ladies and gentlemen, good evening, and welcome to the October 24th, 2006 version of this course, lecture in this course, about some books. Some of you are familiar with one group of researchers that is one of many groups of researchers, and it is part of the general consensus, and I stress the word general, there will always be disagreement. One group is called the Jesus Seminar, which has been operative since about 1987, and which has produced a number of volumes related to historical criticism of the New Testament. Two volumes are the Five Gospels, so that includes the Gospel of Thomas, as well as the Four Canonicals, and the Acts of Jesus. So basically this is the words of Jesus and the Acts of Jesus. And they have color-coded, according to their own evaluation, according to a fourfold color scheme, which we may have mentioned before. Red, almost certainly Yeshua said it. Pink, it sounds like something that Yeshua would have said, but we can't be sure that these are the ipsissima verba, the very words themselves. Gray, which often comes out in sort of like blue in this text. Gray means, doesn't sound like Yeshua, it sounds like the early Christian community. Black means almost certainly comes from the early Christian community rather than from Yeshua. So in the deeds, you'll get the acts of Jesus, you'll get miracles, things about his birth, obviously, and his death. And in the five Gospels, you'll get everything, the sayings and the deeds color-coded. John Dominic Crossan, whom we're going to hear this weekend, has published a number of very important books. The flagship text that he published is called The Historical Jesus, The Life of a Mediterranean Jewish Peasant. This book is summarized, I guess I could put it that way, in a smaller volume that he put out a couple years later that is more accessible for the general reader, and it's called Jesus, A Revolutionary Biography. So it takes away a lot of the footnotes and apparatus and bibliography and so on that might not be serviceable to the general reader. What's most important, or very important, about this book is that in the back, he gives a very detailed, goes on for 100 pages, analysis of what he thinks the database is. So the multiply attested independent sources, the primary strata, the primary stratum and the other strata that he mentions, by the way, in the Apocalyptic Jesus book. It's an invaluable document. I have it as a text file, and I'll put it on in three parts, Crossan 1, Crossan 2, Crossan 3, I'll call it, and I'll put it up on our website so that you can download it and print it out. It's not reader-friendly. I mean, it's very thick and detailed, but at least you'll have an idea of how much scholarship has gone into this, and he's not alone. He's generally representing, in general, those pages represent the consensus, with disagreements here and there, of course, of the mainstream scholarship. But you'll at least see, whether you read it through, it's like reading a phone book, in effect, whether you read it through or not, you'll see how much labor goes into establishing a database so that one then can interpret. And there are going to be various interpretations, but as he says in the Apocalyptic Jesus book, if we don't agree on what the sources are, then we're talking apples and oranges. We have no chance of a real dialogue. Yes, please.
These books are constantly coming out over periods of time. To what extent is your own perception of the historicity of Jesus still changing as a result of books and scholarly works coming out?
The question is, in case those back didn't hear, given the immense literature that continues to be published, how does one evaluate the question, is there more to be learned? Are there surprises? Am I interpreting
exactly.
You correctly?
Yes.
Are there some surprises that we can expect in the future that would undo the paradigm and the findings within the paradigms that are now operative?
Well, more specifically, in your case, you've been a scholar in this field for a long time. Have you been changing your assessment of the total story in the more recent past as a consequence of some of these new findings.
The question is whether I myself have changed since getting involved in this research back in the 70s. The last one, the latter question is very easy to answer. Immensely have I changed from when I first started this 40 years ago as a graduate student, because so much, I mean, the 70s and 80s were there, for me at least, the real explosion of, we'll call it, new information about historical Yeshua, about first century Christianity. Even more recently, I've reconsidered what I say in my book about Yeshua as a prophet of reduced apocalyptic. I would think I would now call it very reduced apocalyptic from what I've been reading and seeing since then. By the way, some of that revision on my part of the reduced apocalyptic nature of Yeshua has to do with literature on apocalypticism, which I've been reading since the middle 80s and early 90s, which has really changed my view on that. As regards to the scholarship as a whole, there are still large balloons of the population who would consider themselves scholars of Yeshua who don't agree with much of what the mainstream is about, or they will agree with much of it but on real crucial points like the resurrection interpretation of Yeshua's death will tend to be more conservative. And these are very good scholars. N.T. Wright, who's an Anglican bishop, would be one example of that. I think he's dead wrong, but nonetheless he's a very serious scholar and needs to be taken seriously. Will there be any revolutions in the paradigm? Whoever says no, it's all over, is a fool, so I won't say that. The sources of the revolution could include material culture. So another find like Nag Hammadi or like the Dead Sea Scrolls, and everything will be up for grabs again, depending on what we discover in those texts. And I see more coming, simply because we've only begun to touch the sands that stretch from Egypt, where there were a lot of monasteries that preserved texts, up through the Middle East, including Babylon, and you know the areas around the common day Iraq. So material culture would be one of the issues that could produce texts, new texts that we haven't seen. As regards the texts that we do have, I think you see that there's enough in flux on some major issues like the apocalyptic or not nature of Yeshua's preaching that I think things are still moving along. Whether there be a major shift or not, I don't know. I really can't say.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Good question. Yes, please, sir.
The fact that there are so many scholars, let me ask you this. Some are Jewish, some are Protestant, some are Catholic. Do you see any subjects?
Some are nothing.
Prejudices affecting them as a group?
Okay, the question is, do denominational or religious commitments of the scholars in some way prejudice, prejudge their findings? I think inevitably, yes. And yet, while that's always a problem in any of the human sciences, what we call the Geisteswissenschaften, sciences of culture rather than of natural phenomenon, while that's always a problem, it is also a problem in the natural sciences, the method itself builds in the constraints. I think that the stronger one is an adherent to traditional Christianity, the more difficult it is to adhere to those restraints, those objective restraints that keep one, let us say, honest. In my own tradition, the Roman Catholic tradition, that has been very much the case. The difficulty of keeping one's theological commitments out of the picture, especially since clerical scholars can lose their jobs, right? They can be silenced, as has happened very recently in Massachusetts. A scholar who wrote a book on wisdom Christology based on the scriptures was told that he couldn't publish in that anymore. And that was only about 4 years ago. So the Catholic tradition has that kind of problem. Nonetheless, I think the method is what you get called on by any of your other scholars. So, you know, I think people are so public about it that it's hard to sneak in one's commitments. But when it comes to weighing evidence one way or the other, that final push could well come from one's commitment. But it's still an objective decision. It could go this way, it could go that way. I think, I feel, I vote for this, even though that I know that the decision is going to be equally balanced. It's a very tricky issue. Yes, another question, please.
Well, related to that, I thought it was interesting, Borg, in one of his comments said that he would expect to see more traces in early Christianity of a crisis of confidence about the delay of the apocalyptic consummation. And it occurred to me in reading that individuals who had made this prediction of an apocalypse, if it didn't happen, would not be inclined to say, I'm wrong, but would hold on to their statement and modify it, as we've talked about previously. And it surprised me that he made that comment, because it seems that quite often in Christianity, if a statement is made, this is the gospel truth, then the person making that statement doesn't want to back away from it, even if circumstances prove them wrong.
Your question, your statement, goes right to the heart of what we're talking about this evening, and it again comes under the umbrella of the question, the topic that's usually called cognitive dissonance. What do you have when you have a clash between new information or new facts, you know, the delay of the parousia, and a certain commitment? But what goes on there is, does one throw up one's hands and say, I'm out of this sect, I leave this sect? That's a possibility. Or does one then modify and change the dating, as we saw at the end of Daniel, or as we see with the Millerites and the Jehovah's Witnesses, who change the dating of it? And what Borg is pointing out there is that a weakness, perhaps, in Dale Allison's and other positions who claim that it was bedrock apocalypticism that issued from Yeshua's mouth and that the community picked up, is that, to use Dominic Crossan's lovely phrase, the longer they got wronger, the stronger they got. You know, so how do we deal with the wronger, stronger thing? Could they not have had other interpretations going of this? And I think that you'll find in Crossan's book, which by the way will be sold at reduced price, I understand, at his many books, at the Stone Presbyterian Church, in his book, The Birth of Christianity, which is about the same size as the Jesus, the historical Jesus, but I think of excellent read, you'll find him suggesting strongly that there were different reads of this apocalypse, just as he's suggesting there were different moments of the apocalypse. Was it social? Was it supposed to be the transformation of the natural order? There was no one hymn book that they were all singing from. Apocalyptic is a very broad spectrum of beliefs in Judaism and Christianity, early Christianity at the time, and within Christianity itself. So your question points us in the direction, I'm not answering your problem at all, but you are pointing us in the direction of the debate that is going on in those pages that we read for tonight. Maybe what we'll do is get underway with the lecture, but not before mentioning that a copy of Biblical Archaeology Review, which is edited by Mr. Shanks, who just recently spoke in the neighborhood, some of you may have heard him Saturday night, I didn't have that opportunity, you'll be passing that around so people can flip through it and see it. It's a popular, accessible, and serious magazine on biblical archaeology. There are many things I would like to do this evening without benefit of PowerPoint, because I couldn't prepare that, and I'm not sure that we'll get to all of them. This is more or less the order in which I would like to address topics this evening. First of all, I'd like to begin in the 21st century and ask what the word apocalypse means today among conservative evangelicals. And I would like to chart for you on the board what the mainstream fundamentalist view of the end time scenario is. Some of you may already know that from your own reading or perhaps even from your own church experience. Many of us don't know what that is, so I'll lay out the general format of it. There will be, of course, variations, just so that we get a sense of what the resonance of the statement Jesus was an apocalyptic preacher could be today. Right? We shouldn't let that influence how we think of the first century, but I'd like you to know what the scenario is that most of the non-mainstream conservative evangelical churches hold. So a Roman Catholic like myself wouldn't recognize this. We never learned this. An Episcopalian of the true variety, non-evangelical, wouldn't have heard this. Methodists wouldn't know about this, etc. It's mostly a scenario that has been concocted over the last 200 years and pretty much codified. And even more recently, in the late 20th century, has been codified even more strongly. So we'll do that first of all. Secondly, I'd like to step back a little bit into history and just make a footnote on what the origins of apocalyptic thinking are, according to the scholarship, in Iranian religion, which Judaism picked up during the Babylonian captivity and the Persian occupation. So the code name for that would be Zoroastrianism, which is the origin of much of the apocalyptic framework that Judaism picked up, at least some of Judaism, and that Christianity embraced after the death of Yeshua, at least after the death of Yeshua. Then I would like to possibly either look at, if, it depends on time, look at some texts of John the Baptizer and see how he was understood to be an apocalyptic preacher. That requires that we also understand how the Christian scriptures subverted his role, reinterpreted his role to make Yeshua more important than the man who baptized him. Yeshua being baptized by John the Baptizer is an embarrassment because of the teacher over the student, right? So we'll see how the scriptures reverse that, but maybe we'll do that a bit lightly. Then, in order to open this debate here, I'd like to run through possible readings of the death of Yeshua that lead to apocalypse finally. So it's quite a menu, and I'll see how things go during the 2 hours that we're together, find out what we can cover reasonably, and still get to the material in the Apocalyptic Jesus, a debate book. First of all, just a chart of what's going to happen any day soon, according to conservative evangelical preachers. The scenario that I'm going to put out, the end time scenario, is frankly a confabulation created by cherry-picking various texts from Ezekiel, from the book of Daniel, from Mark 13, from the book of Apocalypse, from 1st and 2nd Thessalonians, one of which Paul wrote, the other of which he didn't write, putting that together into a mix and a stew that and adding an early 19th century invention called the rapture, and up comes the thing that is taken to be orthodox apocalypticism by many Christians today. So I'll tell it in their voice, if I may. Any day soon, therefore imminently, a man who is present among us now, probably an international diplomat, who is really in the throes of Satan, so he's really a human being operating for Satan, codenamed the Anti-Messiah, or the Antichrist, will achieve a position of prominence in a worldwide body, perhaps the United Nations, and will make a treaty with the State of Israel for peace, protection of the State of Israel. That will be the first sign. When a figure who obviously does not call himself the Antichrist, but calls himself instead, and please, I'm only using these names for purposes of dramatic effect, calls himself Kofi Annan, or calls himself somebody else from South Korea, who's head of the United Nations, when the Antichrist sets up a pact with the State of Israel for protection of the State of Israel, when secondly, one of his lieutenants, called the False Prophet, who's really going to be a financier. The first one is allegedly a Jewish male of the tribe of Benjamin. When a second false prophet, financier, somehow makes a unified financial card that binds the whole world economically under the power of one authority, and on the card will be written 666, that's in the book of Revelation, which refers to a code name for Nero, we believe. At that point, and if you miss those two on the evening news, you won't miss this one. At that point, true believing Christians, not Episcopal, Catholic, etc., will be raptured, taken up to heaven, so that they can ride out the 7-year period of tribulation, in Greek, philipsis. And they will just disappear. And if you've seen any of the Left Behind movies, the two that are out, I've only seen one of them, they just disappear. They leave their clothes. So I guess they go off in their birthday suits to join Yeshua in heaven. Then, for 7.5 years, there's trouble afoot. And this is the period of tribulation. Halfway through those 7.5 years, at the midpoint, after 3.5, the Antichrist will turn against Israel and somehow will place in Jerusalem an image of himself called the Abomination of Desolation, and that will be the beginning of the persecution of the Jews. So there's the statue, Abomination of Desolation, whom you probably recognize from the book of Daniel and the year 165, 175. Right? But in this scenario here, it's read into the future. At which point will come the Great Tribulation. This was mild. There'll be all sorts of course, wars, rumors of wars, earthquakes and whatnot. But this is where the persecution of the Jews reaches its height. Up here are the blissful believers with Yeshua. During this period, mostly the book of Apocalypse is the scene book, you know, the movie book for this. Bombs are going off, nations are being destroyed, millions and billions are dying. Please, I get most of this from, I read all of this literature and have for years, but if you want to go to a reputable source, go to the Complete Works, I kid you not, that's the title, The Complete Works of Pat Robertson, and there you'll get a 3-volume treatise on all of this. And you can judge whether it is pro-Jewish or anti-Semitic, depending on your point of view. At the very end, when things are in their worst state, God will have had enough. He will then send Yeshua back. The Yeshua who was crucified and resurrected will return. No doubt these people will return with him and watch from someplace above the earth. And he will return specifically to a certain valley in northwest Israel. So if Israel looks something, you know, if the land of Canaan, Palestine, West Bank, etc., looks something like this. Right here is Haifa. Down here is, let's say, Tel Aviv. Here's Jerusalem. I'm not sure if I got that right. Tel Aviv, Jerusalem, Tel Aviv, maybe more exactly. And here is a valley that comes down from Haifa. And there's an archaeological site there called Megiddo. I think I've got two, I think it's 2 G's, 1 D, but it might be 1 G and 2 D's. I'm not sure of that. And there's a mountain right near it, and the word for mountain in Hebrew is Har, so it's called Har Megiddo or Ar Mageddon, and that will be the site of a battle between the forces of the Antichrist, and his armies are made up, depending on what decade we're talking about, by Soviet Russians, no, that was out by 1991, by Red Chinese, they're still around. No doubt Arab nations who are unfriendly to Israel and the United States are part of his troops. Again, you make your battle order up according to who the current bad guys are in the mind of the evangelist who's preaching it. And there will be a war, a terrible war. But hands down, Yeshua will win. He will not come in a tank or a Humvee, but on a horse. And the blood will rise to the level of the bridle on the horse. I guess that's either the chest of the horse or the mouth of the horse. There's going to be blood. He's no more nice guy when he comes back. At which point, you will have the first judgment. Not the last judgment, but the first of two judgments. And Yeshua will gather together those Jews, both the ones who died during the persecution, they'll be initially resurrected, that's the first resurrection, and those Jews who survived the tribulation, and Yeshua will give them one last chance. They will look upon Yeshua and see the wounds that they caused in Yeshua. Misuse of a text from the prophet Zechariah 3:3, they shall look upon him whom they pierced. So again, it was the Jews who killed Yeshua, not the Romans, according to this scenario. They will look upon him and have their last chance to accept him not as a Christian Messiah, but as a Jewish Messiah. If they refuse, they are killed. Those who want to observe Torah, those who want to keep their traditions, will be murdered, slaughtered. Those who say, oh, he is the right guy, will enter into a 1,000-year kingdom. And since the word for me for 1,000 is mile, and the word for year is annum, millennium, millenarian. This is the millenarian hope. There'll be 1,000 years of of absolute extraordinary health, production of fruits and vegetables and everything, it will be a golden age. But although Yeshua defeated the Antichrist and the false prophet, and they're now burning in hell following Armageddon, guess who they didn't defeat? The guy who was behind it all. So Satan will come back. There are more books coming in the Left Behind series. There's more movies coming. There's no end to this guy. He will come back and attack this new Jerusalem, this new kingdom, which will be set in the land of Israel. And at that point, God will have had enough. Enough is enough. And that will be the final last battle. So we have to have all of these things to accommodate various texts that they string together. And so you have to have a first resurrection of the Jews, a first judgment of the Jews. Then after this big battle here, you have the final judgment. And it's called the judgment of the great white throne, because the great white throne is mentioned in the book of Revelation, just as the throne was mentioned in the book of Daniel. Now, it's not just the Jews who are resurrected, it's everybody, you, me, everybody who's died over all of these years. It's not clear whether people will die during this thousand-year reign, whether they'll live a long time and die, live forever. We don't have information on that. This is the final judgment. That's the judgment of the great white throne, where we divide up the sheep and the goats of everybody worldwide. And then, at that point, God abolishes creation. For Judaism, that's blasphemy, right? The creation is good. How could God abolish it? But he does. That's the end of the old order right there. And it goes up in fire. You can read that in 2 Peter. And then makes a new creation. What is called a new heaven, which means a new cosmos up there, and a new earth where we shall live, well, those of us who make it, forever.
What happens to the Jews?
They get to come back up too, and I don't know what we do with them, to tell you the honest truth.
And the agnostics.
A lot of them will have died during the nuclear holocaust of the major tribulation, the great tribulation, the last 3.5 years. So they'll be dead and buried, so will a lot of us, and we won't make it up to the throne. I guess we all come up there, and maybe that's where Matthew 25 kicks in. I just don't know. As long as you did it to the least of my brethren, you did it to me, so you can come on in. But I just don't have word on that. Does anyone who's familiar with this tradition more than I may be able to answer that? Anyway, if you're interested in more of this, I've got footnotes that, you know, to various people in Waco and Oklahoma and California, you know, each one with a different story about this. But that's what apocalypse means.
How old is this concept?
This concept goes back to James Nelson Darby, begins there, who was an evangelical preacher around 1817, 1820. He's the guy who came up with the idea of the rapture. There was no such notion of it before Darby. He brought it to the United States. He came over here and preached, and there was a great American revival that found its expression in, does anyone know this phrase? The Scofield Bible. Does that ring a bell with anybody? The Scofield Bible is an important evangelical, a biblical text, which annotates and comments on every possible verse from Genesis up to the book of Revelation, explaining this scenario. It was done not by a biblical scholar of reputation, but rather by a certain Mr. Scofield, published in 1909, if I'm not mistaken, in its first edition, and has never sold out. Just gets renewed every few years. I've got my copy, and there's one in the library if you want to look at it. And it explains how every possible verse that converges on this scenario fits. It's pretty much the Bible of the Bible of conservative evangelicals. Right? The framework within which they put this, beginning again in the 19th century, is called dispensationalism. And as we'll see when we talk about Zoroastrianism, dispensationalism divides up history into dispensations. Can I use these seats here? The first dispensation of creation, Adam sins. Second dispensation up to Noah, and then there's the sin and the cleanup. Next dispensation of Abraham. Next dispensation of Moses and the tribes of Israel coming. Next dispensation, the Davidic kingdom, and so on and so forth. And we're in the sixth dispensation, I think. So it's a way of dividing up history so that we can know that we're in the last age and we're waiting for this imminent event. So dispensationalism is a fancy way of saying what other traditions call salvation history divided up into epics. And each epic has to be fulfilled in the end. That's why there has to be a kingdom that fulfills the Jewish yearning for a Messiah. But it will be ruled by King Yeshua, not by King David or anyone like that. That's an example, and I'm not going to go into details about how their view of history cashes out in the various steps and stages of the end time scenario. It's always imminent. And I kept track during the 80s and 90s of how Jerry Falwell was convinced that it was, Pat Robertson was convinced it would happen within 7 years of the, let's see, the Armageddon would happen within 7 years of the of Israel's invasion of Lebanon in June of 1982. Well, that didn't work out. And Jerry Falwell said it was going to happen in his lifetime. He said that during the Reagan regime, because at that time conservative evangelicals had a lot of power with the Reagan administration. President Reagan himself was a convinced dispensationalist and raptured, absolutely. You can read in, is it James? Is his first name? James Cannon, C-A-N-N-O-N, a well-known journalist who won Pulitzer Prizes. Has a book on Reagan in which he details all of this stuff. I'll find that title if you remind me of that. They were actually giving lectures in the Pentagon to private groups, pointing out how the scenario that was unfolding in whatever part of the world did seem to correlate with biblical prophecy, as they called it. So he predicted it was going to happen in his lifetime. Now he says it's going to happen within the lifetime of his children. So it really depends on when these people... If I think the one to watch is the Mayan calendar, which comes due around 2040. You know, I think I'll be gone by then, but that's a date to remember.
Sooner.
Pardon?
Isn't it like 2017?
Oh, so now you're really scaring me.
Help me reconcile it. This is around 1900. We're still 40 years from the new creation of Israel. It's been thousands of years since there has been an Israel in existence. How did this come to be?
Well, because Yeshua speaks of the gathering of the tribes of Israel together, that is interpreted as May of 1948, the establishment of the State of Israel. So it's going to be within a generation of that. This generation shall not pass away. So they've interpreted generation to very differently. So sometime, that's why the importance for the Christian Zionists who support the State of Israel precisely because it means that time is getting close. They want Israel to have its way as a government. They do it for religious, theological reasons, not telling the Israelis, nor would the Israelis care, right, that finally they're supporting them only so that they will have a chance to either be slaughtered or accept King Jesus, right? But anyway, the 1948 becomes one of the last touchstones, so we have to measure a generation from that. And how long is a generation? I don't know. It depends on how I define a generation.
But I was going to say, if the Scopa Bible is 1909...
Yes.
How do we...
I mean, Scofield Bible...
I'm just saying, like, from the time, this would be quite a stretch. I mean, we see now, thanks for but we're talking 1900. It's been thousands of years since there had been an Israel. To see an Israel coming into existence again in 40 years is...
See, what you're doing is you're pointing out, perhaps, some of the problems with this scenario. The one that always strikes me, and I think I may have mentioned it to you before, is that for the price of a paperback Bible, the Antichrist could read what's coming inevitably and perhaps change his plans a little bit, you know, and then it would require plan B or plan C. But this guy here, you know, who's must have read these passages in the Bible, or must have read Jerry Falwell or Pat Robertson, he just keeps marching deterministically right ahead so that God's plan can be fulfilled. One of the elements of apocalyptic worldview is determinism. Don't do anything, God's going to break in, it's all, the plan is set. In fact, we can predict history, the way George Washington in my scenario predicted the Civil War, etc. So we can predict these moments, and we've got these signs, but they're vague enough, formal enough, that we can fit just about anything into that. Hitler, he was once the Antichrist. Stalin, he died in 1953. you know, when you just keep fitting figures into the moments in time, etc. Anyway, this could take all evening, and I'd prefer to maybe hold it with this last question.
Well, yeah, this is sort of an off-the-wall question, but I wondered, has anyone ever looked at this as sort of a marketing strategy, like what sort of market these guys targeted and how they were able to persuade people to believe all this stuff?
I don't know. I do know that evangelical literature in general is a $1 billion market in the United States. I can find you the exact figure from a New Yorker article in September of 2004, but I think it's a $1 billion market. And a subset of that, you know, apart from normal evangelical literature, is the Left Behind series, the you know, the apocalyptic worldview. It's sort of a subsect that's quite strong, and it's very active on this campus here. Although, again, you're not going to tell young students that they're buying into the full picture any more than when you join the Scientology church, they tell you the full picture about that guy on the planet out there who's, you know, whatever it is he's doing. One last question on apocalypticism before we get to Yeshua.
How does the red heifer fit into this?
How does the red heifer fit into that? Now, there's an article on that in the New Yorker, the New York Times magazine had an article on that. When a red heifer shows up, which is a very rare phenomenon, right? That's a sign of something, and I can't give you the full story.
The red heifer must be slaughtered on an altar in the temple of Jerusalem, which is why you need to have the Temple Mount cleared and another temple.
So that becomes the temple restoration movement that is afoot in Jerusalem, right? Some people are now studying in very conservative Orthodox seminaries, I guess we'd say, or rabbinates, to be able to perform those sacrifices once we clear out the Dome of the Rock and restore the temple. So there's a colleague who knows more about the red heifer than I. But if you email me, I'll try to find the article in the New York Times in which they talk about it. There's an American who's really invested a lot of time and energy, I think, because they've discovered a red heifer, is that not true, someplace in Israel? And I think he's sort of backing the Third Temple movement in Israel. There was also another article on that in the Village Voice, of all places, years ago, but I'm sorry, I don't have that information at hand. But if you email me, I think I could find some lines to it. So you see what a dramatic scenario is invoked in the minds of people and how much is at stake when the debate comes up, was Yeshua apocalyptic or not? As the scholars point out in this apocalyptic debate, Bob Miller, who leads in with a very nice introduction, and Dale Allison, as well as Marcus Book, this was the 20th century's view of Yeshua among bona fide scholars. It were minority voices who thought that he was not apocalyptic. Right? Now the scene is changing. That's why when whoever asked me, you know, do I expect changes in the future, the answer is, yes, I certainly do. All we can do is stay with our method, right, and abide by the scientific historical method and then see whatever comes through and what comes up as the best result. Yes?
You said Reagan believed in this. Does George W. Bush believe in it?
Not that I know of, but Reagan had often and clearly said certain things that indicate that he had read one book very closely, and that was Hal Lindsey's book called The Late Great Planet Earth, which sold a jillion copies in the 80s, and even gave you battle scenes, battle scenarios of how the Soviets were going to come in this way, the Arab nations come in that way. You can still find it in paperback with those pictures taken out, those maps taken out, because we've got new people now, the Red Chinese. So, yes, President Reagan was quite a convinced believer in that. And again, James Cannon's book, I think it's called Reagan, The Role of a Lifetime. Does that ring a bell with anybody? I think that's the title of it. It's a very serious treatment of Reagan's administration, but it goes into this in a long chapter, his ideological commitments to rapture and end of the world scenario.
It's also glorified the book, Imperial America, is a humorous discussion about Schofield and Garvey and
it's called Imperial America?
By Gore Vidal.
Oh, Gore Vidal.
Yes, it's Hal Lungeon, how they kind of captured him, began talking to him. It's a deals with Teddy Roosevelt, among other things, but the whole way United States kind of thing.
So that's Imperial America by Gore Vidal is recommended as having some information on this. Then we can move to our next topic. Very briefly before a break. What is the historical origin, as far as we can tell, of the apocalyptic worldview? Since cyclical history and, for the Jews, epiphantic history, an appearance of God in our midst to crown a king or to save us from Egypt, since those were more common, the most common models for history from India through the Middle East, how do we get a linear history leading to a climax? I guess I should make my hand go from this side of the room to that, reading from left to right. How do we get the notion of a linear history rather than endless cycles where we renew the cosmos once a year, for example, or big cycles as in Hinduism where you go on for jillions of years before you complete one life of a Buddha? How do we get this linear notion? Scholars agree, although the content of what they're going to agree on is going to be up for grabs, that Iran, that is to say Persia, is the source of this notion of history beginning in the 6th century BCE. So let's go there for a bit. Zoroastrianism traces itself to a founder called, I think I'm going to get this right, I don't know a word of Farsi, Zoroastra, which means camel driver, one who manages camels. Okay? And he was a priest of a traditional religion in northern, contemporary northern Iran, northern Persia. The dates given for his birth and death are roughly 630, 628 I think is the usual date, down to about 550, maybe as late as 543. So this is the time of the Greek philosophers, Parmenides and before Parmenides. This is not all that long ago. The book in which Zoroastrian religion is recorded are called the Avestas. While there are few adherents to Zoroastrianism worldwide by comparison with other religions, there are adherents in India and in the United States as well. And you know by their traditional fire festivals. They keep fire burning all the time. Of this great scripture called the Avestas, which goes on for hundreds and hundreds of years, there are 17 poems called Gathas, if I'm not mistaken. There may be an R in there, but I think it's Gathas, written, it is presumed, it is thought, by Zoroaster himself, in which his theology, if you want to put it, which is unique for its time, and his view of the world, a dualistic struggle of good and evil, leading to an apocalyptic appearance or of triumph of good. It's there, among other places, there are commentaries written later in the Pahlavi period, that you find the scenario that we presume Judaism picked up during the Persian occupation of the Near East, the Levant, between 550 and 330. So there was plenty of time for these ideas to circulate. First of all, he's a strong monotheist, as contrasted with the polytheism or the henotheism. Our God is the best God of many gods, would be henotheism. There are lots of them, but one is the supreme God. He insists on one God only, and you won't forget his name, because it's also the name of a Japanese automobile, the Mazda, and that's the name of this God, Mazda. And it means wise one. And since the word for Lord is Ahura, Ahura Mazda, the one God, the good God, the source of all beneficence. All right. Later on in the Sinasid period, from about 220 Common Era up to about 630 Common Era, this God's name will change, but you'll still get that same formation in there. He'll be called Omazd or Omuzd. But the religion will be called Mazdism. Okay? So that's talking about Persia before the Muslim conquest. So one God. But Zoroaster solves the problem of evil by telling a story that you may recognize analogies with the Genesis story. He created a spirit world. The word for spirit in Farsi, in this ancient form of Farsi, is manyu. And if anybody knows the language better than I, please. And there are two types of spirit. The good ones are called spenta manyu. So we put an S, I guess, at the end. So good, beneficent spirits. But one of them revolted against Mazda. Now you get a kind of a satanic revolt such as you have in Milton and such as you have, not in the New Testament, I mean, not in the Tanakh, but in these books. If I had a Bible here, let's pretend that this is Tanakh, and let's pretend that this is the Christian scriptures. That's about the size of the Christian scriptures. In between those two texts were written these volumes of so-called apocryphal literature, where, like the book of Daniel, they use the name of a famous figure from the past, Enoch, Baruch, and they write a story right now, during the Second Temple period, predicting the defeat of the Gentiles and the triumph of a Messiah or a Messianic era. It's in these wildly fantastic texts that we call apocalyptic literature. There are two volumes over here, and they're very well translated and very readable, if you like fantasy literature, that you get the stories that Milton, among others, drew upon to flesh out the book of Genesis. Where did the serpent come from? You don't know where the serpent comes from Genesis. You read Milton, who was drawing upon this, and you find out that he was a fallen angel, as were the bad spirits of who revolted against Lord Mazda, and they become the Angra, mind you. Not that this is going to, you know, this and $3 will get you on BART, I guess, you know, but anyway, just to let you know what's going on. So he becomes the evil spirit. These six archangels become his part of his army. He makes up six demons to become his generals, and they decide to have a war for the rest of finite time. That unfolds in 12,000 years, which is divided into four periods of 3,000. In the first period of 3,000, that's where this revolt takes place. In the second period of 3,000, the good God creates a spiritual world. So it's just got angels, but then decides to take that spiritual world and make it a material world, to have a world where you and I can live. So a spiritual, then a material creation, and it's into that material creation that bad guy Angra Mainyu infiltrates. He infiltrates into that, and there you get something like a serpent in the garden, although that's not the trope that's used in this text. The next 3,000 years are the fight between the good and the bad. Light and dark, good and bad fighting it out. So you get this apocalyptic dualism. Remember, Judaism and even the beginning, Zoroastrianism, has only one God. There should be only goodness. But you have to explain why there's evil in the world. So you create a dualism where the evil is subordinate to the good but can still give it a hell of a fight throughout, you know, these 9,000 years, until finally we reach the last period. And that's always the case. Whether it's in Hindu cycles, we always live in the last period. Or if it's in apocalypticism, we are at the edge of the inbreak of God. Someone tells you it's 5,000 years away, then you forget about it, you know. So this is the birth of Zoroaster. So roughly 600 BCE. This will be divided into three epochs of 1,000 years each. And the final epic will be the arrival of the Savior figure. And his name is, and I'm not sure I can spell it right, so I want to make S-A-O-S-H-A-Y-T, I think. Saoshyat, is that correct? S-A-O-S-H-A-Y-T, thank you.
You've got an N before the T.
There's an N before the T, and that means Savior in Farsi. And at that point, there will be a cosmic battle. Guess who will be defeated? And there will be a resurrection of the dead and a life hereafter. So you really get two ages, an age of goodness that falls into an age of evil, just like the creation becomes the age dominated by sin, a cataclysm after these various dispensations, these various epochs, and then he has a resurrection of the body. Interesting. So if Judaism only talks about resurrection of the body, I don't know what the word is in Farsi, but in Septuagint Greek, which is the way Book of Daniel was written, it was written in Greek, the Greek and Aramaic, but the Greek part is the only part that mentions resurrection. It doesn't use the word resurrection, it uses the word awakening, egersis, Right? That becomes the tradition that infiltrates or soaks into Judaism that Christianity picks up with. So there's been a lot of scholarship on this, both in English and in French. Duchesne Guillemin is the best French scholar. He's now deceased. And I can't think of the name of the English. Zahner, Z-A-E-H-N-E-R. R.A. Zahner, I think, has written a number of books on Zoroastrianism.
Karen Armstrong's new book called Transformations gives a great treatment of this.
She does it as well. And there's one other I want to... Cosmos and Chaos by Norman Cohn, C-O-H-N, who's written many... He's written The Pursuit of the Millennium and this last book. He's retired from the University of Suffolk in England. I think he's deceased himself these last years. Cosmos and Chaos is a nice chapter as well as on Zoroastrianism. Anyway... again, what we're doing is unpacking these things which we take to be kind of hardwired into, say, Judaism or Christianity, and finding out that there's a syncretism of cultures and religions going on there. So now when we place Yeshua into that debate, as we'll do after the break, we'll see what the arguments are for and against. Is there a point to be made before we go?
Just a quick one.
Yeah.
Can I conclude from this that before the Babylonian exile, there was no such concept in the ancient Hebrew text?
That's what we know. That's what we hold, that there was no such dualism.
Yes.
Right? In fact, Satan was God's friend before the Babylonian exile. He was God's district attorney. So if God wanted to prosecute Sheehan, he'd send down Satan. There's the prosecutor, and he'd call my, yank my chain. But then after the Babylonian captivity, Satan gets more and more, he's an ambiguous figure in Tanakh. He finally gets associated with God's, opponent, which may be under the influence of Angra Mainyu, an evil spirit. Tonight we're getting a lot of suggestions of things that we should read, and one of the publications, which is called Committee for the Scientific Examination of Religion, is recommended by one of our colleagues. Just the title itself tells you something about what the approach, Scientific Examination of Religion, and it includes a lead article by John Dominic Crossan, Don Crossan, whom we're going to see, The Unmarried Jesus, Why Jesus Didn't Marry. And if I can manage to scan it, I'll put it up on our site. And there's another article that is, again, I'm simply telling you what I haven't read myself, because this was handed to me by Bill just now. Threat to Enlightenment, meaning the Enlightenment movement from the 1700s on, the challenges to the historical critical method. Analogous to the challenges to evolution by creationists are various challenges that have been going on for 200 years to the scientific reading of the history behind the scriptures, trying to find out what the sources are, how they got redacted, etc. So if this article, if I can scan it, I'll put it up for you. But it's a magazine that you might want to consider. In any case, we have it, I'm pretty sure, in the library. It's called CSER. And that will catch out as Committee for the Scientific Examination of Religion Review, would be the title of it. So it'll be up here if you want to have a peek at it afterwards. Well, we have a lot to cover, and it will be an inadequate discussion and lecture on the book, The Apocalyptic Jesus, but I hope that you will not let the matter rest with our meeting today, but we'll continue this debate. I think it's still a hot topic, a hot issue. Someone like Paula Fredrickson, whom we're reading in this course, holds to an apocalyptic Yeshua, but I think she holds to a secondary apocalyptic Yeshua, to use Marcus's and Dom's word, their distinction. And other scholars of renown do not hold to Yeshua being a non-apocalyptic preacher. I meant to say something about Galilee, and I haven't done it at this, but I'll just say a few things right now to kind of set up a topic that I hope to bring up when we get together next week and begin to talk about Yeshua's parables. We'll look at the book called Reimagine the World, in which his logia, his parables, are laid out. And in that context, I'll say something about Galilee. But Galilee was not a part of Judea. It was considered to be a bit of a rogue province, a backwater, but not only that, but it was the land of diversity because of Hellenic influence. So we would not be surprised to find out that Yeshua had picked up some of the free spirit of the Hellenic cities that surrounded him and that were right in the center of Galilee. He was only an hour away from the very Greek city of Sepphoris. If he lived during his stay at Nazareth, he was only a day's journey away from Gadara, which is across the Jordan, and he even performs a miracle there in the canonical Gospels. So he must have had some influence by the Hellenic atmospherics that he moved in, even while he was a Jewish tradesman. He wasn't a peasant on the land, he was a villager rather than a peasant. But nonetheless, there's going to be a lot that we'll try to say about Galilee that will influence our views, I hope, of how he reads the parables. I can just have 1 second here to gather some notes. Crucial to the discussion of Yeshua as apocalyptic or non-apocalyptic is the fact that he is at least wedged in by two apocalyptic preachers. John the Baptist, about whom we know precious little, but nonetheless the little bit that we have preserved in Q and brought up in Matthew and Luke and also in Mark, not from Q, and the little bit that we have in the Acts of the Apostles indicates that he was indeed a prophet of the apocalypse. He uses apocalyptic language at least in Matthew. The axe is laid at the root of the tree. Every tree that doesn't bear good fruit will be cast into the fire. And he talks about the wrath to come. He tells the Pharisees and scribes who come out to see him, this is only in Matthew, which has a bias against the Jewish community, probably because it itself was a Jewish Christian community that had been thrown out of the synagogue or separated itself from the synagogue. In Matthew's gospel alone, does John say, "You brood of vipers, you know, you bunch of snakes, who taught you to flee from the wrath to come?" Wrath to come is a code word for the tribulation. Right? The tribulation, by the way, is part of traditional apocalyptic stage props, but not the rapture and all of that. Who taught you how to flee the tribulation to come? So John the Baptist is an apocalyptic preacher. However, and again, we have to deal with caution here, making statements about John the Baptist since we know so little of him. It's possible that he was influenced by the Qumran community, which was apocalyptic. But John the Baptist changes apocalypse in one radical way, according to the text that we have from Q. It becomes a judgment not on the Gentiles, but on Jew and Gentile alike. And that's a different kind of apocalypse. The apocalypse was supposed to be to punish the goyim, the bad guys who have been repressing us for these 500 years. But John is reported as saying, "Don't tell me that you're children of Abraham. God could raise up from the stones children of Abraham. There's no privilege because you come from the patriarch." Right? You're on the same footing, and perhaps even in worse condition than the goyim who don't know about our God and our traditions. So that's already a change. And secondly, he turns the apocalyptic crash and burn scenario into guidance for how to change things now. In other words, you can cooperate in some way to live through, make it through the tribulation to come. In Luke, and again it's a rewrite as far as we know of whatever Luke inherited from John the Baptist, he gives three pieces of advice to the concerned Jews who enter into a dialogue with him, and it's only in Luke that you get this dialogue. Say, "Well, what do we do?" He says, "If you have two suits of clothes, give one away. Two tunics, give one away." To tax collectors who inquire, "What do I do? Just don't overcharge. Just collect what you're required to collect," because they cheated and overcharged and took bribes and so on. And to soldiers who came, so presumably Roman soldiers in this scenario, he tells them that justice is what their obligation is. So what you're getting is what I call an existentializing of an apocalyptic scenario. The cosmic stage props are still there in some form. We don't have a lot of that in John. But he's really turning the knife blade to your own heart, whether you're Jew or Gentile, and calling for an inner conversion, an inner repentance. John the Baptist was clearly an embarrassment for Christianity, as we've mentioned before, And so there had to be many different ways in which the Christian scriptures revised this apocalyptic preacher to make him predict not the coming of God, it isn't God's revelation, but he's given a role one step back. Before he's even asked who he is in John's gospel, he says, I'm not the Messiah. I'm here to proclaim the one who comes after me. I baptize you with water, but he's going to baptize you with, there are two words that are used here, God's Holy Spirit, which is not the third person of a Christian triune God. It's not Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. Holy Spirit means God's own life, God's own holy life given to you to participate in. Spirit means breath in Hebrew, ruach. And that breath of God will fill you. So it's the equivalent of what we called one of the A's, letter A, in our treatment of apocalypse, the anointing, the pouring of oil, not on just one person, a prophet or a priest or a king, right? But it's pouring the blessings of the messianic age on all people. That's called God's breath, God's life, God's spirit. And in all the, in three out of the four Gospels, or is it also in John, I can't remember, when Yeshua has the personal apparition, it's not available to everybody around him, according to all the synoptics, right? When Yeshua sees the sky break open, that's an apocalyptic revelation, right? And he sees God's Spirit descending upon him. Notice it's a private revelation. No one else sees it. It descends on him in the form of a visible dove. And then the voice comes, says, you are my son. That is to say, you are the Messiah. You are my son, in whom I am well pleased. Okay. And you know the historically true story. I won't waste your time with this. January 3rd, 1959, a moment that rattled the Eisenhower administration, when Fidel Castro and Che Guevara and all the lads came in from the Sierra Maestra province and finally arrived in Havana. They come in the evening, and Fidel gives one of his, the first of his many historic three-hour speeches. Right in the middle of that, here we all are standing in the audience. We're Catholics, we're Santeria mostly, and check Life magazine. Out of the sky comes a dove, settles right on his shoulder, and stays there for the 2.5 to 3 hour, do we need any more proof? You know, if we belong to a Santeria tradition or a peasant Catholic tradition. It's an amazing thing. I'm sure it sent shocks through the Eisenhower administration. You know. In any case, it's only to Yeshua that that revelation is made, that he is the one who has the breath of God upon him. And all sorts of tricks are played in order to make John the Baptist subordinate to the man that he baptized. In John's gospel, he doesn't even baptize Yeshua. He simply reports that he saw the Spirit coming down upon him. Right? In the synoptics, he always says, I baptize with water, but it's not enough. You need the baptism with the Holy Spirit and fire, the real apocalyptic thing. Well, you could imagine the people, if this were an historical statement, saying, well, why did we come all the way down here from Jerusalem, wade across the Jordan River, get ourselves all wet, go back, you know, with a cold, when it wasn't the real baptism that mattered, right? Now he's telling us we need a second baptism from the real one sent by God. So that contradiction within the text leads us to believe that those words, which put Yeshua in the real prime position and John in the second position, are not historically true, but are written in by those who need to revise the picture of John the Baptist at the time. So an apocalyptic preacher before Yeshua, but one with a different kind of message. It's much more personal, existential, and it's not that political divide between Goyim and the chosen people. And a full-blown, on steroids, apocalyptic preacher after Yeshua. The first voice that we get about Yeshua in any language, in any text, is Paul the Apocalyptist. In the first chapter of his first epistle, verse 10, it's called 1 Thessalonians, verse 10, we are awaiting from the heavens the Lord Jesus Christ, whom God is going to send us to save us from the wrath to come. Absolutely, by 50 CE, when that is written, 50 to 51 is written, Christianity is an apocalyptic religion. So that's one argument why, if Yeshua is boxed in by a teacher who was apocalyptic, and he's spoken of as apocalyptic throughout the scriptures. He must have been apocalyptic in his orientation. That's the one of the, if you will, arguments made by Dale Allison in his quite intelligent book. Again, they treat it with respect because it deserves respect. If he's from that whole tradition, if we get the whole first century after him being apocalyptic, certainly he must have been apocalyptic. How could they have gotten it wrong? The counter-argument being that the first text we have is 50, then there's a break in 70, and we get apocalyptic texts. If those texts are constantly revising the text that they inherit, what Crossan calls absorptionism, they take it over and rewrite it for their own purposes, then can we not imagine that Mark did the same thing to the traditions that he inherited from Mark from his scribal and oral sources, or Luke and Matthew from Q, which has statements in it that can be read apocalyptically but do not necessarily have to be read apocalyptically. I think Marcus Borg is the best on that when he goes through the types of sayings by category and points out that they can be judgment statements, threatening statements, without having to have crash and burn apocalyptic scenarios built in to them. So that's part of the framework within which we operate. What Borg does is offer, I think, a framework that, regardless of the topic that he puts into it, namely apocalyptic, non-apocalyptic, is a very interesting model for scientific research. And it's about how to do a paradigm and what you need a paradigm for. The particular content that he's talking about is Allison's claim of apocalypticism and his own claim of non-apocalypticism. But the way he sets up how a paradigm works, first of all, how it gets generated and on the basis of what. Secondly, how much material it covers, what it has to exclude in order to remain a paradigm, what it includes in order to, and thirdly, how it explains, how well it explains the material that is included. It's a nicely laid out, I think, piece about just how paradigms work at all. And then he breaks it down. Step number one, if in order to get an apocalyptic Jesus at the end, you start with a paradigm rather than starting with data, and then looking at the data and on a hunch basis coming up with a paradigm, then basically you've decided the question before you've argued it.
Sure.
You know, so that's the one of the major issues in Marcus Borg's critique. Paradigm is supposed to be, you've got a question, so your question already frames what you're looking at. You're looking at, and we know what the sources are. You're looking at Q, you're looking at Mark, you're looking at Paul, you're looking at special Matthew and special Luke. All right. So you've got a question and you've got a field of material. But then you start to shake that material to science, try to see what things cohere with each other. That's called the insight, or Bohr calls it the hunch. Bernard Lonergan calls it an insight. Okay, that's only a working guess from which you build an hypothesis. But again, the material data which you've collected because you have a question that you share with Crossan and with Patterson and with others lead to this hypothesis, the role of which is to see if it can be comprehensive, if it can cover everything, comprehensive, and secondly, if it can persuade. If it offers a meaningful story about that. And only on the basis of that would you come to a conclusion. And if you find that you have to exclude an awful lot or important elements, then you will probably want to go back and reformulate your hypothesis. But it still will try to be both comprehensive and explanatory, persuasive explanatory. Let me spell this out. Comprehensive. That means what you include and exclude, right? And then persuasive. And out of that will come your conclusion. So no results without a matrix, but no matrix without a material base. So the text that I'm going to put up, I hope tonight, are precisely this area here of texts that we have from the various sources, which Crossan, with great labor, has pulled together and stratified Okay, which comes earlier? Which is the primary stratum, Q and Paul? Okay, it doesn't matter which one comes before that. Next strata up, it's Mark. Next strata above that, Matthew and Luke. So he divides that into pre-canonical texts, right? So basically Q, intra-canonical texts, Paul and the four canonical gospels, and then para-canonical texts, those later texts which he does, which we're not dealing with here, that sometimes reflect earlier traditions, like Q, like Thomas rather, which is formulated, redacted probably only about 120, or the Gospel of Peter, which is the first resurrection scenario that we get, actually showing you the resurrection taking place. None of the canonicals show that. That may have had some roots in the first century. So pre, intra, and paracanonical database. And that's what Allison doesn't work out. He's got a lot of, you know, corroboratory evidence, John, Paul, and his other arguments, but that's the real issue there, that's going on there. A second major issue, and for this we go to Crossan, is that apocalyptic, which is a literary form or an imaginative form, right, of religion, is hardly a unity in Second Temple Judaism. First of all, not everybody holds to an apocalyptic view. The apocalyptic view has to be one in which God does all the work. It's the difference between the book of Daniel, don't pick up the gun, God does all the work, and the Maccabees, let's pick up the sword, the M16, the revolution, right, in order to help God along in his inbreak. Apocalyptic is, if you will, passive in the sense that it waits for the divine, and the other is a liberation theology. You fight for your freedom, right? There's that kind of distinction already that divides those who are non-apocalyptic. You wouldn't call the Maccabees apocalyptic, those who are apocalyptic. Then when you get into apocalypse itself, you have as many different variations as you have here. For example, apocalypse sometimes is not about the end of the world, surprisingly. Apocalypse is often about a journey that a seer takes, led by an angel, that's always the supernatural interpreter, and they go off into God's cosmos and find out how the stars work, how the dead survive afterwards. In other words, it's a kind of a pseudo-scientific tour of the cosmos as a way of eventually saying, you know, God's in charge of everything, and I guess he could come to wreak vengeance at the end of time. But you have spatial apocalypses as well as end-time apocalypse. What's the common thing? It's revelation of information that you couldn't get on your own, you could not acquire, so you have to be the passive recipient of it. So I'm holding here about, let me see, some of these actually go into become a Christian, Jewish and Christian apocalypse. This is 1,000 pages, and this is 984 pages. So you're talking about 2,000 pages of text written between the 2nd century BCE and real cutoff point is 100 CE. Some of them are a little bit later than that, Slavonic apocalypses, etc. So what I'm saying is, apocalypse is far from a unified literary form. As again, Crossan points out, under Jewish apocalypse, you can have a Messiah or a messianic kingdom without a Messiah, when you're talking end-time scenarios, not spatial apocalypses. If you have a Messiah, the Messiah could be a king, or it could be a priest. The Essenes, as he points out, had two Messiahs, and only one final end. The Christians come up with one Messiah, but they have two ends. First he came and was rejected and was taken off to heaven. Then he'll come a second time when he'll be vengeful and he'll be seen and he will rescue people. So two messiahs with one end, one messiah with two ends. That's just an example of the different scenarios that you get. So far from being a unified structure in itself, the apocalyptic view is multiple. So Crossan breaks it down into a bunch of categories, and I'm not sure I have my notes on that yet. Did I need those in the printer? I guess I did. He makes the distinction between destructive end times and transformative end times. Now, indeed, in many of the stories, it's not the end of the world. It's the end of the old world of sin, which transitions into a new creation over here. The question that Crossan is asking is, how destructive does it have to be? Does God have to repeal creation, which is, again, blasphemy for traditional Judaism, right? And then start up a whole new world? But we thought this world was good. That would be a surrender of this current world to the demons, to Satan. So is it destructive or is it transformative? Secondly, if it's transformative, is it a transformation of nature as we have in the millennium, the thousand-year rule, where everyone will be smart, as they say in Prairie Home Companion, everybody is beautiful, everybody's above average, and we'll live long lives, and there'll be no illness or sickness, or etc. Do we require that kind of utopian transformation of the natural order, or a social transformation, which is a lot closer to what Yeshua is talking about, where people will actually be nice to each other, where justice and mercy will be the name of the game and the whole... And again, Crossan in his very... he's really debating hard and not always nicely in this, despite his Irish courtesy. Ah, what a wonderful book. He really cuts these things pretty sharp-edged. Huh? If you had the choice, which would you take? Would you take that the land is producing a lot of fruit, but I don't get any of it? Or would you want the land to be whatever it is, but there's justice for us, the working class, the peasant class? He thinks you would take the social transformation rather than the natural transformation. If it's social transformation, then he breaks that down. Do you want social transformation to be active or passive? Do you have a role in it or not? Right? Can you cooperate with God? Is God waiting for you to do something, or are you just sitting there passively waiting for God? How will he treat the Gentiles? Will he kill them off? Whether now the Christians are killing off the Jews in their end time scenario, or will Judaism become, as it was in Isaiah, the light to the Gentiles? So it will embrace them. It will not even require that they be circumcised, only that they recognize that there is one God, and that they obey ethical rules, not the kosher rules, not circumcision, not the 630-some-odd commandments, but that they abide by the diaspora Jewish rule, which was basically the Ten Commandments, right? And so on and so forth. In other words, which does Allison want? A primary apocalyptic with the full complement of stage props, or this term that both Borg and Patterson also alludes to it and Crossan used, which is secondary apocalyptic. The message is really about this. And oh, by the way, sometimes we use this kind of framework to describe it, but what we're really after is justice, mercy, radical access to God of the outcast without priestly ministrations. Right? If that's what the core is, then you've got, at best, secondary apocalyptic. That's one set of questions, but as one of the colleagues was discussing with me and pointing out that I had confused you about in the first hour, what's the difference between apocalyptic and eschatology? First of all, the word eschatology doesn't exist in ancient times. It's invented in the 19th century by German scholars. And it has something to do with the culmination of history. There could be a culmination of history that is things getting better and better and better because of the divine processes working through it, or because of the natural scientific progression of humankind. Anything that looks forward to the future and has something to say about end times is an eschatology. In religious language, it always has to do with some sort of theological culmination of history. Only in certain types of eschatology do you have apocalyptic. That's a particular way of ending history, of bringing history to its climax. So that I was absolutely wrong and misleading when I was pointing out the connections between Iranian Zoroastrian eschatology and Jewish apocalyptic, and I was calling both of them apocalypse. Iranian is end time scenario, but let's reserve the word apocalyptic for just those characteristics that define Jewish apocalyptic. That's too narrow for some scholars that want to include other kinds of apocalypses, but I want to stick with just Judaism. It's got dualism, it's got determinism, It's got prediction, and it's got the five A's, of which prediction is the sixth, I guess. Absence of God, appearance of God, Revelation, the anointing of the people, the awakening of the dead, and this is the predicted part. The fact that there are different ages and you can predict when the new age is coming. Why don't we reserve Apocalypse just for that? Then there are secondary characteristics to it that you find in the prophet Joel and others. So the sun turning to darkness at noon, the moon dripping blood, earthquakes, wars and rumors of war, all of these are secondary, as I call them, stage props for describing what they saw as the inbreak of God, word eschatology. This again is a 19th and 20th century word, meaning end times, theory of the end. Right? Apocalypse is only one way of talking about that. In my own tradition, in the Catholic tradition, for example, there's an eschatology that basically has no apocalypse. It's there on the books, but nobody is calculating their mortgage by whether or not the end time is going to come soon. Instead, Roman Catholic and general mainstream Christian eschatology is death and the soul goes to heaven. So my great-grandmother's in heaven, both my grandparents, all my grandparents are